حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل، نعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد، وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. أما بعد، the third reason by which our obligations become easy on us is the adab of Allah, the punishment Allah has promised those who do evil or do not listen to Him. This adab and this punishment, what it does is that it creates a fear in the hearts of the believer, like for example the fear of lightning for a child, where the child will listen to the lightning and he will, that child would cling harder to the mother or the father. So what this fear of lightning does is that it brings him closer to his parents. It makes him embrace his parents. Just like that, the fear of punishment, the fear of hellfire, the effect is that it brings us closer to Allah. It makes us cling to Allah and want and increases our love for Allah. Those people who are afraid to speak about the adab of Allah or hellfire or for these type of things is because they don't understand why Allah is mentioning, or the wisdom by which Allah is mentioning that here to us. This is why He mentioned that to us, so that the effect of that could be that we can come closer to Allah, and that prayer will be more enjoyable for us, it will be more endearing for us. You see, my friends, now yesterday I spoke about adab and how real it is, and obviously it was scary, and the azab of Allah, the hellfire, is scary. It's a scary thing. But, you know, I want you to understand something today regarding taklif that we have here, so that you understand where the azab fits in and what happens. You see, when we look at the life of even people who do not believe in Allah, when we look at their lives, we see that their lives are not void of laws or obligations that are put on them or they put on themselves in order to make their lives organized. You see, there's no such people you can find nowadays who live by no laws. Right? There's no such people like that you can find right now. Everyone has laws, and you see that they live by certain laws that they made up for themselves or they have above them for their own organization. And when you look at these laws, a lot of times you see that the laws that are made by people are always a lot, always to the extreme, always more complicated. Whenever men make laws, whenever people make laws, their laws are more complicated, more extreme, and more abundant. And Allah, knowing that the system of law, what happens is that when you make laws, you should not make a lot of laws. You should make it such that people have room to breathe, people have room to move. But if you make so much law that people start suffocating, you see that it deprives the people of growth. Where else you see that they're not able to go there or do anything else in life. My friends, when you look at this, the laws that we have, let's say in the United States, laws that are made by people, man-made laws. We have so many laws here, and the laws are so complicated here that You need representation if you have any problem with the law. Meaning that you need to hire an attorney, right? You need to have an attorney in order to represent you whenever you have a problem with the law. Meaning the law is so complicated, you can't do it yourself. You have to, it's so extreme and complicated and abundant that you need a professional to tell you that this is what you need to do, or to advise you on what you have to do. See, in Islam, we don't have lawyers. Islam, there are no lawyers. In the Islamic justice system, there's no need for lawyers because the rules are so simple, the rules are so easy that anyone who knows it, anyone who's a Muslim would understand the rule and would know how to defend himself. But the laws here are so complicated, you see that anyone who gets into a problem with the law, really they need a professional, they need an attorney to represent them. Otherwise you see that if you want to do it yourself without knowledge of the law, you get yourself in trouble. Into more trouble. How many cases have we witnessed that an individual who has just have a speeding ticket ends up in jail because he doesn't have the right representation. My friend, this is what happens in laws. People make laws. When people make laws, they make a lot of laws, abundance of laws. And when you do that, people start suffocating. Now in this society, the reason they need to make laws, why didn't Islam make these laws? Why did Islam make a lot of laws? I'll give you another reason for it so you understand it better and in detail. My friends, you see, what Islam did, it came and made laws to prevent people to be and act and behave in a certain way. Islam came and stopped alcohol. Islam came and put on hijab. Islam came and rectified the society and did what we call a preventive method rather than curing the problem. What Islam did is that Islam made sure that the society doesn't become so wild that you will need to make an abundance of laws to control it. The reason why you have so much laws here is because from the beginning the society is not controlled. When you have people who are drinking, when you have people who are not wearing hijab, when you have people who are enticed to the extremes of their desires, and you have this sort of freedom that is given to them to do whatever they want, then what happens is that in such a society, the police needs to be stricter, the laws needs to be more extreme in order to control a society like this. That's why you see, for example, a lot of people say, oh, over here, everything is so normal, this and that. Brother, if you look at the police here, you know how stricter they are than other places? You know how harder they are than other places? Why? I mean, you go back and this and that, you see a police officer, you can joke around with him, do things, this and that. Right? Here, if you had to do that or something like that, right, you come and say, oh, okay, let me see your ID. Why? Because of the fact that they know that the society here is so wild that they need to be that strict in order to control that society. So they make these laws up. So many laws are made, why? In order that they know, they understand that their society is in need of those laws. If you don't make those laws such, then the people, obviously, my friends, understand this. It's easier to control a herd of animals than to control human beings that have a free spirit and who are free. It's easy to control that. You get people drunk, you get people living according to their desires, they are so drowned in their desires that their heads are not thinking. It's easy to control them. It's very easy to control them. The art is when you don't let them do this and become human beings and have a free spirit and free and be sober, then start managing those people. Then you see
get away with anything you can do. You know, for example, you know, you have a child who's crying. You know, it's very easy, you know, to give him some sort of painkiller. You know, a child's Tylenol or something, make him go to sleep. Right? He's so drugged up, you know, that the infant can't cry, he's just sleeping. It's very easy to do that. But let him be sober, let him be free, let him be free of these type of things and then start to manage it. That is true leadership. That is true management. That is true administration. So my friends, when we look at the laws that have been made up, you see that the laws that are made up in this world are such that in the ayat of the Quran it has come that the Anbiya, Allah sent the Anbiya to do what? It is said that the Anbiya, the prophets, were sent by Allah to free the people, to break the chains of their hands, and to free them of these chains that they're tied in. And in the tafsir, we see that when they say, what is this chains? It is said, these chains are the man-made laws that are binding them and suffocating them. It is these laws that have been made by men that are suffocating them. So everyone makes laws and everyone is under those laws. No one is complaining about these laws. But one difference I want to point out between the laws of this world and the laws of Allah. So that you understand and have hope now from here. Understand the laws of this world, how America makes laws, how any of these nations and countries make their laws, and how Allah makes the laws. My friends, whenever a law is made here, behind that law is an iron fist. There's a iron, there's hard, there is no heart behind it. It's cold behind it. A system, when it makes a law, that system, when you make a law for the computer, you see that computer doesn't have a heart to say that, listen, here we should have some sort of sympathy on this person. We should have some sort of care for this person, some sort of compassion for these people. A computer doesn't do that. A computer will just give you the result. Whether it's good or bad, it doesn't look at that. It'll just give you the right result, meaning that this is the result of it. But when a person is dealing with you, then that person will look at your situation, will look at your idea, will look at what you are going through, and then when he makes a law, he can make sure that that law is overchanged also. My friends, in this world, if you do not obey the laws, what happens? You have to face the punishment for it. You have to go to jail for it. Whatever you have to do that. But behind Allah's law is Allah who is compassionate and merciful. Allah is compassionate and merciful. So if you break Allah's law, if you do not do something that Allah has said, then what does Allah do in return? He says, alright, I'll give you another chance now. I'll give you another chance. I will give you time to change. I will let you make dua so that you can change. Allah is saying that if you break my laws, do not worry, I am there to be compassionate for you. I will give you Laylatul Qadr so that you can make dua there and change yourself still and ask for forgiveness. My friends, Allah is behind His laws. In other words, if we fail or if we do not do something, there is compassion behind Allah's laws. And there is that mercy that's behind Islamic law. In these laws, there's no mercy nor compassion. They are blind to that. Really, the laws that have been made by Allah, Allah is behind them. That's why when Rasulullah came, when you look at Rasulullah, Allah said that this prophet of mine is dying for you all. That's how much he has love for you. On one hand, he gives you orders, but on the other hand, he's dying out of compassion for you, out of love for you. You see, the people who are giving the love also are so compassionate, so loving, so merciful, that there's hope behind. If we fall down, if we have a flaw, if we make a mistake, there's hope behind that. You know, Imam Hussein on Ashura, when he came forward, organized his army on the right and on the left, had everyone together, and then when everyone was ready, he asked a question. He asked a question to his army. He said, I want to ask something, everyone. Pay attention. Everyone looked around at Hussein. And he said, Imam Hussein said to them, that is there anyone here who's indebted to someone else? Who has a debt that he owes to someone else? Who has a loan that he owes to someone else? You know what? A person said, you know, I have some loans, this and that. I have to pay off some loans. He said, then you cannot be here. Please go away. Go away from my army. You cannot be here. He said, but Mawla, I would lose this chance to give my life for you. Do this. I want to give my life for you. This is the chance I have. I don't want to lose it. Imam Hussein said, no, you'll have to pay off your loan before you can be in my army. Before you can be in my army. He went and he got some things together. He made a wasiyat and a will to someone else and said that, please, if I die, give this as a loan to this person, this person. And then he came back and told Imam Hussein, now I've arranged for my loans. Then Imam Hussein allowed him to come. My friends, even there you see Imam Hussein is making sure that you as my followers are taking care of your duties. You see that compassion is there. When you are in the leadership of the Imam, Imam is not just looking at you as a soldier who comes here and is going to be a statistic later. When you are under the leadership of the Imam, he is looking at you as someone who is caring for you, making sure that you are doing your duty towards Allah, that you are cleaning yourself. Even at that time, Imam Hussein should have been like, you know what? I'm asking these people, I only have a handful of people. And the life of my children, the life of my woman is at stake. Their lives are at stake. And I'm making it harder for them to stay and asking them to leave. See, but understand the situation. I mean, you want more people to come there. Come on, more people come here so that I can be defended, my children can be defended, this and that. But you see, Imam Hussein is making it even harder for the handful he has to stay there. Why? Because he wants to make sure that they take care of their duty. This is the compassion behind the law. So if there is azab, like Imam Ali says in the Quran, in Hajj al-Balagha, he says there, that Allah, if you put me in hell, in Dua Humail, he says, that if you put me in hell, I will be calling out from hell saying, Ya Rabbah. I will be calling out from there knowing that I love you. You are my focus. How can you do that? Hai ha. Is he? Why are you saying that? He said that hell is what? How can you put someone in hell that you are behind that? That you have that much compassion. That you have that much love for. Imagine behind it, my friends. These are obligations, my friends. Obligations is something that when we look at the azab of Allah, when we look at the reward of Allah, then you understand truly that this is how these obligations that we have, how they become easy for us to do. How Allah made it easy for us to do. And how they will define us if we are good or not. It is obligations that define us. Do you do what Allah has asked you to do? That's what will define that if you are good or not. If you don't do what Allah is asking you to do, it doesn't matter how much you claim. that you are mu'min and this and that. Really, my friends, this is the game. I mean, this is the plan and the plot of shaitan against the mu'mineen and Shia of today. This is their plot, this is his plot, that he's making them claim and do things that they made up because they think that they love Ahlul Bayt, and when Ahlul Bayt are asking them to do something, they don't want to do it. You see how much we defy Ahlul Bayt. You want to see how much our people defy Ahlul Bayt? Look on Ashura and see how much they defy Ahlul Bayt. How much they are against Ahlul Bayt. That they will do what they made up themselves to do, but they will not do what Ahlul Bayt has asked them to do. They will do what they have made as rituals, and they will be emphatic on it. But what Ahlul Bayt have said, what Allah has said, make Dhuhr and Asr. You see how many people make Dhuhr and Asr. You see, this is where it counts. It doesn't matter how much you claim, how much you have done. Have you done what they have told you to do? Have you done what Allah has told you to do? This is what's more important. This is what's more important. My friends, today is the wafat of Hadrat Khadija, the wife of the Prophet, the mother of Fatima. And just a few words I will say regarding her, so that inshallah we can remember her and her greatness and her maqam and her adhamat that she has before Allah. You know, just to remind, just to go back in history before I come to her wafat, you know, just go back in history, how she met Rasulullah and how she fell in love with Rasulullah, you know. This wife of the Prophet, Khadija, was a lover of knowledge. She was a lover of knowledge. She loved ulama. She loved to be with ulama. She loved to discuss things and learn things. She was obviously a rich woman. We all know that in history, that she was wealthy. She had a flourishing business. But all her time she used to spend in learning. Her cousin by the name of Nawfal was a Christian monk and an alim of their books. She would get him, there were others who were there, and she would have gatherings. She would invite them to her house, and they would come there to have gatherings to discuss things. And she would be interested in that. And from there she learned about the prophecies of the old, the prophecies in the Injil and Torah. These ulama used to speak to her and she would be enchanted by these prophecies and enchanted by these things. And from there her love grew for that prophet that was prophesied in Injil and Torah, that she wanted to marry. That she really wanted to just be with and say that, how can I serve him? How can I serve him? You know, when she met the Prophet, Prophet was young, he was looking for a job, and she offered it to him. And after he came, just by his behavior and how he acted, she saw the signs of a person who has those qualities that have been mentioned by those ulama that speak of those things, of this person who is going to come. And listening to all of that, when she could see her and how she behaved in that way, I want you to just imagine one incident I'll mention. I don't have a lot of time to go in details. Just one incident I'll mention, that, you know, how much she was, when you look at her, she was a very dignified woman. She was a dignified woman, and it was one of those business caravans that had gone to Syria, and he was also gone there with the caravan. He was the leader of the caravan and the head of the caravan. On his way back, she was sitting on her roof with her friends. Her friends, obviously the elite, And she was also from the elite, high-end people, very wealthy and this and that. Dignified people, they had servants, do everything, they won't do anything. And she was speaking about the Prophet, this and that, I have this person, who is this, this and that. And her friends are listening, her, you know, friends are listening, girlfriends. And they looked at her and they saw that she was so, you know, she had so much enthusiasm when she talked about the Prophet. The Prophet stopped a little bit outside of Makkah and he sent the manager to go and tell Khadija we are back and to let her know what happened on the trip. He came to inform her. He came to inform her that this is what happened, we are back, and this is that, and we made so much profit, so much this, so much that. He gave the report to her. You know, and when she was on the roof and she heard that the Prophet, there was a knock at the door. And she thought that it was the Prophet who came. It is said that she ran there like a girl who is completely in love with someone. She was like a girl, acting like a girl. She ran downstairs to open with so much excitement. Her friends looked at that and said, "What is wrong with you? You are a dignified, wealthy woman and he's just an orphan. He's just an orphan." And obviously, they couldn't understand her point of view. She was in love. She was in love with the qualities of the Prophet. She was in love with the Prophet. And she wanted to, and at the time she made the, or she wanted to give a proposal to the Prophet, she wanted to see what his viewpoint is on marriage. So she asked him, after he gave the accounts and this and that, she asked him, "Aren't you, you're of age of marriage and now you have money also, you gain money from this trip. Why don't you get married? This and that." And Rasulullah said, "You know, whatever Allah wills." Then he said that, "What are you looking for in your wife?" She asked in order to see what his thinking is. He asked the Prophet, "What do you think of a wife?" Right? What do you want to see in a wife? He said, "I want to marry someone who is in status either equal to me or lower than me. But not someone who is higher than me." Meaning more wealth, more name, more shohrat and all that, famous and all that. And she became dejected because she knew that in status amongst the people, she's higher than him in wealth and, you know, famous and all that. And you know what she did is that when she invited him back, you know, she gave the proposal and she knew that he would not accept it because she's in status higher than her. She said one day to him, he said, "I want to do something right now." He said, "What is that?" He said, "I have signed over all my wealth over to you. Now you are higher than me in status and in wealth. Do you want to marry me?" You know, everything she had, she gave to the Prophet before they got married. He said, "Now it's yours. I am also your property now. I've given myself to you. Now you do what you want with me." This is how much she had endeared herself to Rasulullah. My friends, everything she gave up for him, for his cause, everything. This is why, you know, when she was sick, Rasulullah, and every time Rasulullah used to pray to Allah that Allah has given me Khadija as the earning of my life. Whatever I have done in my life of earning, of doing work for him, Khadija is the reward for me. And he used to pray that I want her. He used to ask Allah, "Allah, give me Khadija as a mate in Jannah so that we can be together for the rest of our lives." This is how much the Prophet used to love Khadija. But the time came, and the way that she died is that when she died, there was no one there. She called some woman, some Muslim woman who were there, and she said, that I'm dying and this 4-year-old daughter of mine, take care of her. If she's ever in need of a mother, do not let her feel that she is despaired. She is going to be alone. This is how Khadija passed away. When Fatima, she came to the Prophet, recognizing she was young. Obviously she's masoom, she's young. But in that age, you know, she came to the Prophet, noticing that her mother is not there, asked the Prophet, Aina ummi ya abi? Aina ummi? Where is my mother, father? Where is my mother? I don't see her here. I don't see her here. Rasulullah could not reply to her. Rasulullah could not reply to her. And she started to cry. Tears came out of her eyes and it was rolling down her cheek. Jibreel came to Rasulullah and said, Ya Rasulullah, Allah sent an order for you that go and say something to Zahra, say something to Fatima. The heavens cannot stand Fatima crying. The heavens cannot stand, they cannot stand Fatima crying. So Rasulullah started to tell her that, listen, after this dunya, there is a Jannat, and in Jannat there are so many great things and so many blessings of Allah and so many gifts of Allah. Your mother is over there. And then when she heard that her mother is in Jannat, then Fatima stopped crying and there was a smile on her face. A 4-year-old, how would she feel when the mother goes away? At least by cheering her heart, you can make her feel better. But we saw another girl who was 4-year-old in Karbala asking for her father, Ruqayya, when she asked for the father, Aina Abi, Aina Abi. Then they sent her to the body of Hussein. When she went to the body of Hussein, no one came to tell her, no one told her that don't Ruqayya, don't go there. You won't be able to see your father's body. But Sakina went to the father's body, but she saw a beheaded body that's lying on the ground. So many injuries in the body. But her love for her father was said, Ya Abi, oh my father, you have left me.
So, Allah.